Next matter on for oral argument this morning is in regard to the estate of Arnold Lilo. Counsel, if both of you are present, you may approach and get situated. And while you're doing that, I'll remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel to use for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of the audio of the arguments on through our publicly available audio recording. There is a button on the lectern which allows you to raise or lower the platform to your height for your convenience. And whenever you're ready to proceed, no rush if you're still getting situated. Appellant's counsel, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jason Rather of the firm Kennedy & Rusum. We represent the appellate's petitioners, Mark Lilo and Tammy Klon, in this matter. We are here before the court to respectfully request that it reverse the district court's decision, which denied our petition to reopen the will, and thus allow the matter to proceed on its merits. I would first like to discuss the standard of review, because there was some dispute about this within the briefs. Our cases, our brief is replete to case sites that explain that the abuse of discretion standard applies when the district courts are being reviewed for the laches determination. There's two potential elements of abuse of discretion: a misapprehension of the law and an application of clearly erroneous facts. Now, there's a obvious confusion here sometimes between what is a clear error standard when considering fact-finding and what is an abuse of discretion. I think that this distinction is obviously made whenever there is fact-finding, whenever there's credibility determinations or testimony. That is not what occurred here. There was no fact-finding. There was not even any discovery. This is something that petitioners discussed with the court at the outset of the hearing, and the district court agreed we are not here today to go through evidence or hear from witnesses. So before I moved on, I just wanted to discuss that standard of review.
So is the relief you're seeking simply reversal and remand to have an evidentiary hearing?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
An evidentiary hearing on whether or not to reopen, or an actual evidentiary hearing on the merits of the fraud claim?
An evidentiary hearing on the merits of the fraud claim, I believe, is part of that process. The district court could also determine whether laches would still apply.
And if the argument is that the record was not adequately developed or the on the issue of laches, could that evidentiary hearing also include whether or not laches should prevent recovery?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. There's so many glaring holes in the record regarding what people's knowledge were. This is something that could be developed through discovery, depositions, and testimony. We just don't have that at this stage.
Is there case law that requires an evidentiary hearing for a district court to apply the equitable doctrine of laches?
No, there isn't, Your Honor. The district court can apply that doctrine without an evidentiary hearing, depending obviously on the facts that are presented to it. I would argue that in this type of case, where you have a black and white difference in opinion between did somebody know something, did somebody not know something, where the evidence is as unclear as it is, that it would require an evidentiary hearing to resolve that. Obviously, each case is going to be different depending on the facts of the case. Laches is an affirmative defense. It was the respondent PR's burden to show that laches applied. There's three elements of laches I wanted to discuss: unreasonable, blamable delay, prejudice resulting from that delay, and whether it would be inequitable to bar the claims based on laches. Of those elements, I first want to discuss prejudice, because I think this is one of the most striking errors within the district court's order. Now, as was explained by this court recently in the Bruinlett decision, 822-0331, that was a January 3rd, 2023 opinion, But going back to the 1925 decision of Briggs v. Buzzell, the Minnesota courts have repeatedly explained the prejudice is that which results from delay. Did the delay force the other party to somehow change its position such that reopening claims would be an unfair prejudice? It's not just the burdens of litigation. In that Brundtlett decision, this court rejected precisely that type of burden that the district court had applied. In that case, it was actually a fact finding that the court had done earlier, not a pre-evidence motion hearing. But regardless, again, it is the prejudice, again, connected to the delay. Now, we've cited cases in our brief where prejudice was found by this court upon reopening a probate, such as the sale of a business, that's the Henry Brensky case, the disruption of an ongoing testamentary trust, that's the Henry Redmond case, or most commonly, when assets have been distributed to various family members. A few cases, Henry Trust Warner, Henry Estate of Willie, there's a number of those cases. Now, interestingly, the word prejudice does not show up once in the objection or in the hearing or really any analogs to it. The closest we get is a reference to an undue burden. An undue burden is not legally cognizable prejudice.
But let me ask you this. The governing statute we're talking about, 524.1304, provides that a district court may deny a motion to vacate a probate order that is brought within the 2-year statute of limitations based on latches or where it appears that granting the motion would be inequitable in view of all the facts and circumstances. That second part doesn't expressly require a prejudice finding. I mean, could we read the district court's order as, in fact, basing the decision to deny the motion on that second ground?
I think that would be an erroneous reading of the court's order. There's no discussion within the court's order addressing that separate element. I have looked. I did not find any cases, and certainly none were cited by the respondent, where this district court upheld or denied a decision on reopening probate based on that second statutory requirement. And if I've missed one, I would, if respondent has one to share, I would like to.
Is there any case law discussing what that second requirement requires?
Not that I've seen, Your Honor.
Me either. So tell me, opposing counsel cites cases saying, well, you don't even have to have prejudice for latches. Do you agree with that?
I don't, Your Honor. I think that fundamental to the definition of prejudice is this idea of, I'm sorry, fundamental to the definition of latches is this idea of prejudice. Throughout the 100 years or more that these courts have looked at latches, it has connected the idea of delay causing some harm to the party that is seeking or that is facing the claims. On that 1925 case, the court explained it's because the other party may have shifted their position, which is another way of describing prejudice. I do think that it is a central element and that latches inherently requires that.
Is the case law clear enough that no precedential opinion is warranted in this case if we happen to agree with you, or do you believe a precedential opinion is necessary?
I don't think that's necessary, Your Honor. I think that the district court actually obviates that by its own acknowledgement in its opinion. I just want to quote briefly from the district court, the personal representative did not provide the court with a specific argument as to the prejudice that may result. There's some rest of the sentence. That sentence alone, that clause alone, is enough to merit granting the relief we're requesting. Now, the district court found that while acknowledging there was no specific prejudice, as this court is required again and again when making a determination on latches, it added its own thoughts about that, saying, well, it's logical that this would be an undue burden because of litigation. Of course, that's logical. That is true every time there's claims being brought. There's not a situation where a side doesn't face some burden. Now, even if, and I'm not arguing it is, but even if that burden was sufficient, there's nothing in the record to show that that would be an undue burden to the estate. There's nothing in the record that was presented showing that, for example, the state could not afford to engage in the litigation. But regardless whether or not the state could afford to engage in litigation, that doesn't change the requirements of latches. Because according to the district court's logic, if we had brought the petition on September 29th instead of September October 1st, we would not have been barred by latches. There's no difference to the burden to the estate whether we had brought it on September 29th, October 1st, or in this case, December, I believe it was 28th.
Or at least we don't know on this record.
We don't know.
There could have been something, but we don't know.
There may be. And, Your Honor, I'm not able to argue on that one way or another because the record just doesn't give me enough to work off of.
This is probably a question I should ask of your opponent, but I'll give you a chance to weigh in. It seems to me regarding that last phrase and perhaps a consideration of prejudice in general, does it matter that we're dealing with an assertion that a will was forged and then submitted to the court for probate? I mean, I'm just kind of thinking this through. It's like you could have something between. I mean, this seems to be sort of a fraud not only on the interested persons under the will or the lack of the will, but also on the court. So should that matter? I mean, should the court have a greater interest in ensuring that a document that was submitted to probate was legitimate?
I believe yes, Your Honor, and that goes to the equitable considerations within latches. Equity, and I'm just jumping around a little bit, equity involves some weighing of the concerns of each party. This is, again, baked into the whole concept of equity, going back to cases describing he who seeks equity must do equity, those types of cases. Now, in this case, I want to compare those types of burdens or prejudice that the parties may face. If we are wrong, if respondent succeeds in whatever sort of litigation may file and shows that the will was valid, yes, the estate had to bear some burdens of litigation. Again, that's inherent in our American system of justice. Now, that burden will be narrowed because, as Mr. McEntee explained during the hearing, we can narrowly tailor whatever litigation follows to the facts in dispute. Moreover, respondent could even seek the recovery of her attorney fees as they attempted to do in this matter. On the other hand, if the petitioners are correct, the burden that they face, the prejudice they face, that if this petition is denied on the basis of latches and is not, and that is not reversed, they forever lose the opportunity to challenge a will that was potentially the product of forgery that disinherited them completely. I think that's an extreme stark difference between the burdens that the parties face. I want to discuss the knowledge beforehand because that is another element of the latches, is whether there was, importantly, blamable, unreasonable delay. Now, this is another example where the record is exceedingly thin in showing what petitioners knew or might have known. Again, we're looking at the date of September 30th, because according to the district court's logic, that is the point of no return. As the court is well aware, we have described in our briefs this criminal investigation that occurred in April of 2022, where there is a very surprising revelation, where a notary recanted her statement to a law enforcement officer at potential criminal exposure to herself to admit that she had lied, that she had not been present during the signing of the will, and that the respondent had brought the will to her. Now, this is a very stark, very extreme revelation, one of the two reasons that my client brought this petition. Now, in determining what petitioners knew and when, the court relies solely on Mark Lillo's email of February 18th, 2022. That email, I think, speaks as important for what it doesn't say as much as for what it does. This was sent months before the criminal investigation, so there's no way Mr. Lillo could have been responding to that.
He knew at that time, didn't he, that his uncle was thinking about bringing the action? Wasn't there some indication that he was aware of that generally?
There is some indication that he had some concerns about the will. What those concerns were are completely absent from the record.
But Mark, the record does show he met with a lawyer.
Yes.
He then told, if not Block, one of the other witnesses to the self-proved will, that he had a good case, that the will to set aside the will, to get the will vacated. What other knowledge was needed to to expect him to not sit on his rights until the final probate order was issued?
It's not clear what that good case is. Was it that he believed that there was undue influence? Was it that he believed that the decedent lacked capacity? Any of those things could have been true. We just don't know based on the record that we have.
Counsel, it's my understanding that the police reports were generated months before the closure of the estate. So I think in March, statements were taken, police reports were made. Did your client not have access to those reports?
Your Honor, I mean, this is getting a bit beyond the record, but I believe that through an evidentiary process, we can show that the clients had no knowledge of the criminal investigation until after the probate closed. There is nothing in the record to show what Ms. Klein knew when or what she knew. In fact, the district court's language reverts to a singular male pronoun when it's talking about the petitioner's knowledge. It's as if the district court herself may have forgotten that Ms. Klein existed. There's, again, the only thing that we have is a request for the return of her deceased mother's jewelry. This request, in a way, actually strengthens our case. If she didn't believe that Ms. Block was entitled to the estate, she wouldn't have been requesting, or may I please have some of my mother's jewelry back? There'd be no need to make that request. It would be a very different nature of a conversation. I just want to briefly mention that I see my time's up.
You can finish your thought.
I believe that the Herbert versus the City of 50 Lakes case is very relevant here. The landowners, their property was encroached by some road construction in the 1960s and 1970s. They could look out from their window and see the encroachment. However, they didn't bring a case until the late 90s. And the reason that the determination of laches was reversed was because this court found that they didn't have specific knowledge that there was an encroachment, that the city knew about it, but they weren't expected to go out there and look. Maybe that's close enough that there might be an encroachment. I'm going to get a survey. The court found that that wasn't a necessary predicate to bring in a claim, and that it was only once the landowners had their own surveys done and they knew about the encroachment that they should have brought the claim, which they did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I'm Joseph Gangi. I represent the respondent in this matter, Robin Block. I would like to start by noting some observations on kind of the bigger picture here as far as the procedural posture goes and the relief that appellants are seeking on appeal. One of the chief arguments appellants are making, and one that they've repeated here today, is that they need discovery. And it was error for the district court to decide this motion to reopen without going through a discovery stage or an evidentiary hearing or that kind of thing. To be sure, they're not entitled to discovery in this procedural posture. This is a motion to reopen. The probate case is closed. There is no test to see proceedings. It's not a petition to look at whether the will is actually valid. It's a motion to reopen the proceedings so that they can do that. So in that process, they file a petition to reopen, they submit affidavits, there potentially is an objection, and then there's a hearing on the matter, and the district court makes a decision whether to reopen the estate or not. There is no discovery process in that procedural posture.
But if the proceeding were reopened, then there could be discovery on the issue of fraud.
If the proceedings are reopened.
If probate were reopened.
Correct. If the proceedings are reopened, then the appellants would bring an actual petition for fraud or whatever the case is.
And there would be a trial on that petition.
Correct.
Before the district court with
Correct.
Discovery.
Correct. And then there would be a contested case proceeding with all the discovery and all of that and a contested evidentiary hearing. Correct. At the motion to reopen stage, not so much.
How was your client prejudiced? How would your client be prejudiced by reopening probate and allowing for the proceedings on the allegation of fraud?
So with prejudice, it's not precisely the it's not just the burden of litigation. It's the burden of litigation knowing that the proceedings were closed, or they should have been closed. The reliance that she put into, okay, you're not going to pursue this against me because...
So what did she do? What evidence is there that she relied on that in a way that would now be to her detriment? Other than perhaps, I thought the property was mine, now it might not be.
Right. She altered her position.
How?
By not only distributing property she didn't need to, but also potentially not pursuing any kind of formal settlement of the claim so that
were reopened, wouldn't she still have the ability to pursue a formal settlement of the claim? Why wouldn't she?
Well, the property has already been distributed.
Well, but couldn't she also argue a court unsatisfaction if the matter went back for a hearing on the original petition?
She could. She could. And I think to that point as well, we have kind of this second ground of equity. We have facts and circumstances involved in the entire case. And the court in satisfaction, although that could be an affirmative defense in a later proceeding, right now, it is one of the facts and circumstances that the district court considered in weighing the equities. There were many of these facts and circumstances that the court looked at. That second ground that we're looking at as far as the exceptions to the statute of limitations, that's not a latches determination. There's two separate things. Latches is one thing, which perhaps has a prejudice component to it.
But do you agree that there is a prejudice requirement?
I don't. I believe the, what is it, the Aronovitch case?
Says that, or are you just relying on Aronovitch, where there seems to be a throwaway line, which is, well, prejudice isn't always required, but then a large paragraph quoted from other cases saying, you need prejudice, it's an important consideration, and here are the things that constitute prejudice.
Mainly the Aronovitch case, but there's also the Will case, or Willie, W-I-L-L-E, which talks about changed circumstances, and in that case, property was distributed, much like in this case.
Who was it distributed to? I mean, I'm aware that there are some cases talking about prejudice and that, well, that there was a building, I sold it to someone else, I don't have it. Is there any indication that she no longer owns the real property or she no longer owns the vehicles?
Not on this record, Your Honor.
That's the sort of prejudice, though, that we commonly see when property is distributed. In other words, I can't give it back to you. I no longer have title to real property.
Right, and that's not in this record at the moment.
The other concern I have is just our ability to effectively review this order, given the district court's failure to really go into any explanation as to why, why in fact your client that it would be unfair and that she would cause great hardship. I mean, it's hard for me to understand that in the absence of explanation.
So to address that point, Your Honor, the memorandum goes through factual findings by the district court. And those are the facts and circumstances that the district court is relying on when it weighs the equities. And among those, we have the reliance on the settlement. We have information on the decedent's intent and what the decedent wanted. We have the fact that the police investigation did not result in any kind of prosecution.
But you also have the fact that the police recommended criminal prosecution after they talked to the witnesses involved in the execution of this will, and you have inconsistent statements between those witnesses. You have a person who told the police she notarized signature of the will in the presence of decedent and then told the police, actually, no, that didn't happen. Your client brought the document in, signed, and said, here, would you sign this? And then your client told her, tell the police it happened at the house. I mean, those are an awful lot of red flags. So county attorney chose not to pursue it. It doesn't eliminate all of these other facts.
Those are all facts and circumstances, absolutely, Your Honor. And that is a discretionary decision on the district court's part to weigh those and decide whether or not to reopen the estate.
Is it possible that the district court abused its discretion by weighing all of those facts, which I think would certainly survive a motion for summary judgment on a fraud contest, against well, she has an asserted prejudice, but it would be an undue burden when we've got lots of case law saying that simply the hassle of having to go back into litigation is not the kind of prejudice that will suffice.
Again, the district court has the discretion, and to say that it abused its discretion based on all of the facts and circumstances, I don't think is warranted in this case, especially when the appellant sat on this since at least the February 2022. Now, one of the things appellants have argued, and this goes kind of back to the discovery piece to it, is that there are glaring errors in the record, or the record's not complete enough because we didn't have discovery and that kind of thing. They did not need discovery to get that information before the court. That's all information they knew. As far as the Mark Lillo's email from February 2022, for example, it could have meant something else. Well, if it did, then submit an affidavit in support of your motion, your petition to reopen, and tell us.
What evidence was available to the district court in the time of this hearing about Tammy's, the sister's, the daughter's knowledge? I mean, we see these references to Mark and what he understood and emails he sent. But it doesn't seem to me the record is as clear that the daughter had knowledge and sat on her rights for these 9 or 10 months.
So my response to that, Your Honor, is that, firstly, this was a joint petition. At no point were these two folks represented by different counsel. At no point did they ever make different arguments.
But they have separate interests.
At no point did they explain what those separate interests were. At no point did they make any arguments for separate treatment.
Well, they each have a separate stake.
And that stake was not presented to the district court. It's raised for the very first time on appeal that Tammy has a different knowledge base or a different stake or should be somehow treated differently or that the motion to reopen should somehow be granted as to one petitioner and not the other.
Why wouldn't it be self-evident that they should be treated differently?
Self-evident that they should be treated differently.
Well, they have different interests. I mean, they each have an interest in the outcome. And one may fail, but that doesn't mean the other. Why is the whatever fault that comes with sitting on one's knowledge? What's the basis for ascribing that fault to the other?
Because it's a joint petition, and there was never any arguments as to different treatment between the two, and the petitioners never submitted any information regarding Tammy Jo and whether she had different knowledge or should know different things. In my view, on the motion, I keep saying motion, it's really a petition, the petition to reopen, they're the ones with the burden to come forward and tell the district court why it should reopen and to give the district court enough of the equities in their favor so that the district court can balance it in their favor. But they did not do that. Instead, they were basically silent on most of the facts that they're now complaining the district court didn't have. And I don't believe that they can be found to now complain about that on appeal when they had every opportunity to present those facts to the district court. At the hearing as well, one of the first pieces was the district court asking whether there would be testimony, and the response was no. Certainly there would not be testimony on the actual issue of whether the will was valid or fraudulent, because they haven't gone through that proceeding before. But based on the objection, if appellants wanted to submit affidavits in reply, they could have. If they wanted to present testimony in support of their motion to reopen, they could have asked for that, and they did not.
Even if one could say, because I think under the case law, the standard is that the person knew or should have known that about their right, and they should have asserted it sooner. I mean, what do we do with the fact that we're talking about a 3-month delay and no assertion of prejudice?
I would not agree that it was a 3-month delay, Your Honor. The hearing, they knew about their rights in February, and the hearing was in February.
There was no police investigation with all these new details.
Well, in February, what we know, at least from Mark Lillo's email, is that he Ernest Lillo was contesting the will, and that he saw a lawyer, he had a good case. The result of that good case was throwing out the will. And then 2 months later, we have Ernest Lillo basically making the claim to police that we think this was fraudulently made. So the district court can use those facts, though, right, and infer, okay, understood, they knew that back in February.
But isn't there a difference between a party who says, this seems fishy, I don't know if this will is legit, and a party who then is made aware through a police investigation that inconsistent, all these other things? I mean, you seem to be saying, well, if someone suspects a will is valid, invalid, but they have no proof, they should nonetheless just file the petition, raise the objection, and have litigation about the validity of the will. I mean, do we fault them for waiting until they had, you know, some damaging evidence?
Well, in February, it wasn't just a suspicion. Under their own words, it was, we have a good case. And just because in April they have maybe a better case.
Yeah. Well, a good case could have referred to the fact that he's old, he's been the subject of this trauma, all these other things.
No other ground for throwing out the will has ever been brought forward. And again, if they had an explanation as to some other ground for explaining that February email, they should have told the district court that. What we have, though, is the record that was presented to the district court. And based on that record, the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding the delays from February.
If we were to think that the record that was presented to the district court is insufficient to sustain the district court's decision that latches, bars reopening, what then should happen? So your opponent has said, well, then we would go back and litigate the underlying fraud claim. And, of course, the other side could further develop its latches claim as a defense to the fraud claim? Or are you, I mean, you seem to be saying, you know, if we reverse the district court, then we just go back and have a trial on fraud. Latches has been determined.
Yes, I believe so. I mean, this was a motion to reopen, and the district court made a decision that it should not be reopened based on these two grounds.
And if we reverse that decision, what happens on remand?
If you reverse that decision, then the motion to reopen would presumably be granted. And then you would go forward on a contested case on the fraud.
Okay, and would you then still have the opportunity to raise your latches defense to the fraud claim?
I don't believe so, because latches is built into the statutory exceptions to the motion to reopen specifically. There may be other defenses to raise at that point, but I don't believe that latches is appropriate.
That's helpful. Thank you.
I see I'm out of time. Thank you for
thank
your
you.
Time.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. A few things I'd like to address.
And again, if you could restate your name for the
thank court. You, Your Honor. You. Jason Rather for the petitioners, Tammy Kahn and Mark Lillo. There was a reference or a comment made also in the brief that they had the same attorneys the entire time. I will represent to this court that they had the same attorneys as of December. That's when we filed our certificate of representation. Any allegation that we were representing Mark Lillo in February of 22 is false and is not supported by the record at all. There's been some talk about a court insatisfaction. Leaving aside the fact this wasn't part of the district court's decision at all, when you're looking at a question of settlement, what are you settling? We don't know, as the court has pointed out, what Mr. Lillo could have meant that he was settling. You could, for example, settle a claim of undue influence, but maybe not settle a claim of forgery you learn about later. Obviously, that comes into the details of whatever settlement agreement is reached, but it doesn't necessarily mean that because he asked and received some property back, that he now forever gave up any ability to bring a claim. If respondents wanted that, they should have had him sign a settlement agreement. There's been a number of comments made on why we didn't do X, why we didn't do Y. It is the party asserting latches. It is their burden to show whether latches applies. That's a Mendota Heights versus Lilydale case in 1972. There's a number of other cases. I at least am not aware of any case that shifts that burden for some reason within the probate context. There's been some comments about what Ernest Lillo knew and when. Ernest Lillo is not one of the petitioners before us. Whatever he knew and when and how he communicated that is exactly the type of thing that could be developed through an evidentiary proceeding. There is somebody who knew about it, though, and the person who knew about it, without a doubt, was Ms. Black herself. As we explained within our brief, a PR has fiduciary duties to the interested persons in an estate. One of the classic fiduciary duties is a duty of candor. As such, Ms. Black, we believe, as a personal representative, had a duty to inform the petitioners about this ongoing criminal investigation. Would that have been uncomfortable or embarrassing? Absolutely. But that doesn't change the fact that she had this duty, which goes to the relevancy that's relevant to our discussion on equity. Again, equity comes down to who is at fault here, who should have done what. In this case, I think it's clear from the record that if anybody had the obligation to share this information, it was Ms. Block herself. Unless you honestly have any more questions, I see the rest of my time.
Doesn't appear there are any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rather. Thank you, Mr. Ganji. The matter is well briefed and well argued today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both.